Welcome to Start Writing. I'm your host, Joe Bendosky. Today we'll be interviewing Mike Sano, and we will talk about his choice to go indie, his struggle to find a genre that fits his type of writing, and his book, Miles of Files, and how he's developed his just incredible strength of prose through writing poetry and songs while he was younger. And so here is the interview. All right, this is Mike Sano. He is the author of the book we're reviewing this week, Miles of Files. I can tell you right now, Mike is, as far as prose go, one of the best authors I have ever read. If you want to study prose, you need to read Mike's books. He is fantastic. We're going to talk about it more in depth with him. But for right now, Mike, why don't you just kind of talk to us about your book, the genre you write in, and maybe how you developed your writing.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for the compliment going right out of the gate here. my background is I was an English major in college, and I actually went on to get a master's degree right after I got the bachelor's. So I was kind of an English teacher's dream student. You know, everything they were giving me was pretty much what I wanted to read anyway. And I actually went beyond what they were assigning to me, and read all kinds of other stuff. You know, beyond the requirements. And as far as my own writing, I really started out in high school and even into college as someone who was writing a lot of poetry and songs. And it was only when I got into the latter part of my college career that I started to really think seriously about trying to write any kind of long-form fiction. I hope that answers both of those questions.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, your prose are just, well, I guess maybe talk to me about your genre a little bit. What is the genre you see yourself writing in? Like, when I picked up Miles of Files, I really felt like it was kind of like the casual vacancy. And I don't really know how to genre the casual vacancy, but that was definitely kind of the story that I felt like I was reading.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm actually not familiar with that title, so I can't comment on the comparison. But my background and my approach to writing fiction has always been something that I thought was outside of a genre. Yeah, so I would, originally putting these things out there, I was looking at them as being literary fiction. And it's kind of funny because when you get something that you're putting into library systems or trying to get it into library systems, you put this little thing on the copyright page called a CPIC block or something like that. And when you submit all the information and you submit your book to the company who creates them, it's called the Donahue Group, they actually put little categories in there. And according to them, I wrote a thriller. So, the book does have a crime at the heart of it to some degree. But that's really mostly between the protagonist and the antagonist. And there are all these other characters in there, which, you know, these folks are not really involved in that crime. They might just comment on it. So I don't necessarily think that people who read crime thrillers all the time are going to pick this up and find that it fits right in with everything that they are used to reading and everything that they like. But on the other hand, I think it's much more of an accessible novel than a lot of other literary fiction out there. So, you know, if you ask me what genre do you write in, I would say, no, or none, or all of the above or something. But, for this particular novel, I think maybe we could actually have it be a crossover into the sort of the crime fiction, the thriller type genre. And I guess that's up to the readers to determine.
So, yeah, definitely. So, I mean, as far as sales go, how has Amazon tried to pigeonhole it, since its release?
Well, since I'm the novelist and I own the publishing company that produced it, I'm not doing this as an Amazon Create Space only author. So it actually goes from Ingram Spark, which, you know, that company does the print on demand, and they also send it to Amazon as a distributor. So I don't have direct promotion from Amazon. I will if I get it up into the, you know, top 100 in one of the categories. What I hear is that Amazon will actually actively promote it for you. But I chose the sort of subcategories that it's in on the Amazon listing. I actually chose all of those myself.
Okay. All right. Talk to me. I saw that you have your own publishing company. Is that just producing your own work, or are you publishing other authors as well?
So far, it's only been my own three novels, and I launched it with this idea that literary excellence is more important than a financial formula. Because so many authors out there who are writing great stuff are trying to get it into these big five publishers, you know, the biggest companies, and they're not getting any acceptance at all. They're not even getting an agent, much less getting published. And you know, and the reason for that is because those big five companies are only going to take so many chances on a debut novel. It's really a loss leader for those companies. They know that they're going to make a ton of money from certain books that they publish, and so they're willing to take a chance on X number of authors, knowing that they're not actually going to really make a lot of money, or it's unlikely that they'll make much, if any, money off of the literary types. So when I put this out as a brand new company and launched it, I actually launched it with all three of my novels simultaneously coming out. And the way that I approached it was, I'm going to be looking for novelists like that who are in the same boat that I was in prior to publishing. And unfortunately, the submissions that I've received, I've had to reject because they just weren't the types of books that I could even evaluate properly. Right. They were in some sort of genre that I don't have any familiarity with. And so it was kind of like, yeah, I'm not your guy. I mean, maybe it's great stuff, but I don't even know if it is.
Right.
So I just kind of had to say sorry, you know. So far it's just me, but that's, you know, that's subject to change.
I guess as you've gone into self-publishing, do you use an editor at all, or do you use software? How do you go about that?
Well, the three books that I wrote each went through a process on my end of about 7 years, and part of that was the actual original draft, and then a lot of it was rewriting, you know, going back over and over and trying to improve upon them. And then, you know what they say, no book is ever really finished, it's just abandoned.
Yeah.
So eventually I did actually hire someone as an editor for all three of the novels. And this person actually went through and did content editing in addition to copy editing. As an indie author, I was able to edit my editor, unlike someone with a big five publisher where you have to just take the changes that they make or you're in breach of contract. So I went through all three books line by line, deciding which changes to accept and which to ignore.
Right.
And which to consider, but make a different change instead of what was suggested. So it was pretty challenging.
So, well, I think that's kind of the dream any author wants in working with the editor, is the option to say, no, that doesn't fit with my vision. You know,
right.
I interviewed a romance author, and she was telling me that she had killed off one of the characters in the first book, and the editor said no. So she killed the character off in the second book, and the editor said no. And she killed the character off at the beginning of the third book, and again the editor said no. So she just kept killing it off repeatedly until the editor just got sick of sending the manuscript back, because she was just moving the death further into the book every time. But I definitely think a lot of authors would appreciate that creative freedom. And so I think that's kind of a great deal you had there. So I guess kind of depending on when you brought in this editor, I know from just the writing side of things, there's a tool called Grammarly. You've probably heard of it. And since the rise of Grammarly, there's kind of developed this small group of kind of scammers who claim to be editors and are just punching the work into Grammarly. And so a lot of writers are very concerned about how to find an editor in the age of Grammarly. And I was wondering if you know, when you hired yours, was that something you had to deal with?
Sure. You know, I'm actually not familiar with that particular tool because everything I've done has always been a very old school approach of just going through and looking at a Word document and just scrutinizing it. And the editor who I worked with is someone who I knew personally, who's a former colleague of mine. And this person had actually does work with someone who was in a writing group that I formed years ago. I hate to even admit how long ago it really was. But I, you know, since I knew the owner of the company and I knew this particular person personally, I felt like, okay, this is someone I, you know, as they say in business, this is someone I know, like, and trust.
Yeah.
And therefore I feel like we can work together. So I never even thought about the work being plugged into something. I just kind of figured it was done as a labor intensive thing.
Right.
And it did appear that way to me when I was getting the manuscripts back. But I can see where that's a valid concern. And I feel like if you're an independent author like myself and you're looking to hire an editor, you can't go cheap. You know, if you think you're going to cheap out and go on Fiverr and find somebody who's going to edit your book for $300, or if you're going to get one of your buddies to do it, you get what you pay for, and you can't expect to get a good result. You know, it's not a fun process. It's not, oh boy, this will be great having my book edited. You know, my books are my babies. I don't have, you know, my wife and I don't have kids. And so, you know, I send this baby out and I get the baby back and the baby's all marked up and there's all these little cuts on my baby. And, you know, I mean, that's really how it felt. And it was excruciating. And going through the process line by line, yeah, it's great to have that freedom. And I could not function any other way. I would be in breach of contract if I were with a big five publisher and they made all these changes. I would say no to this one and no to that one. But going through it and seeing all that stuff and having to make decisions on each one was very difficult. In the end, I actually took about 70% maybe or more of the editor's suggested changes, which is a lot, and a lot of them were helpful. But it was very tough determining which ones to take and do they make it better, do they make it worse. It's not fun. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah. So I've heard a lot of people talk about it. I mean, it's like critique group, except it's the whole book all at once.
Right. Well, and the other aspect of it is that, you know, I had to really take my ego out of it completely. And I feel like I'm pretty good at being objective and being able to look at something I wrote. Mm-hmm. And if somebody makes a change to it that makes it better, I can see that it made it better a lot of the time. But if it doesn't make it better, or if it makes it worse, or if it's just something I would not do and it doesn't sound like my voice anymore, or it has a negative impact on the rhythm, and that's very important to me, then it makes it very difficult. And that was, you know, part of my experience.
All right. So talk to me about your marketing. I was reading through your blog, and you have a small book that you give away that talks about marketing. So talk to me about how you go about your marketing and of the tools you use, what do you find to be most effective and time efficient?
Sure. Well, since I am the publisher and the writer, I do it all. And as you said, I've got that little freebie on my website as kind of a way to get folks to join the mailing list. And that's really for other authors. I kind of feel like a lot of the people who are going to want to read my books are going to be other writers who, you know, like yourself, have an appreciation for prose that is, you know, meant to be appealing. I don't want to say it the way you said it because I'm you were very complimentary, and that would be it wouldn't be humble of me to say it like that. But I would love to agree with what you said about my writing.
So, well, it is fantastic.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying that your writing is fantastic. Like, it really is really good. Like I said, I recommend you to any writer to study. Like, I put aside 10 minutes every day where I study craft. And after reading your work, you are on the list of work that I want to study and I want to write more like, because it's just so well done.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, I really did give these books everything I got. And I'm one of these people who, you know, the way I think about that question about marketing is, you know, how do you find new readers and all that? I mean, I tell everyone about my books, not just online, but in person. I'm like one of those let me tell you about my grandchildren people, only with novels. Yeah. And I do have the email list, and I'm growing that with that book giveaway, that you know, free marketing book giveaway. But also for people who aren't writers, you know, I'm going to be trying to enroll some of those this year by giving away a free book of short stories, and that's sort of in process right now. But the deadline is sometime in 2017. That needs to be up and available on the website, so that if you, you know, join the email list in exchange for getting your email, which I know is precious to everyone, you'll get a free download. Instead of a free PDF of a book about marketing, you'll get a free download of this collection of short stories. And the big thing for me, to answer your question about marketing, is I really have been doing a lot of different things with social media in addition to the email list. And I focus a lot on Twitter. I've got 12,000 plus followers, and I'm always trying to be engaged with that and grow that as much as possible. And I found that Twitter's been the most effective for me personally. That might not be the case with other types of authors, you know.
So on Twitter, I mean, I get a message from them every once in a while about sponsored tweets. Have you ever tried that, and did it work?
I have not. I actually did some studying on Facebook ads, and the company that did this new cover for me for Miles of Files, this is a relaunch of Miles of Files this month, March of 2017, and by the time our podcast comes out here, this will be it'll have been a couple weeks past that date. It was March 10th. But the Facebook ads campaign is part of the relaunch, and that's something that is done by the group that that I got the new cover from. And I have seen sponsored ads on Twitter, and I have very seriously considered it. I haven't done it yet, but I just haven't pulled the trigger. But I've also been working with another author who is a literary fiction type, and he and I and at least one or two other people may be doing kind of a joint effort with some giveaways. So it becomes like a cross-promotion, cross-pollination, where you get exposure to other people's audiences and they get exposure to yours, and theoretically it's a win-win. So
right,
we'll see how that goes.
So, all right. Okay, so let's dig into craft a little bit. And this is something I ask everybody. And so if you could go back to the very beginning of your writing career, and you've been writing forever, so let's go back to when you first started writing novels. What's something you wish you knew when you started that you know now?
You know, my big thing, if it were the older me talking to the younger me, I would say, don't worry so much. It wouldn't even be about craft. It would just be, you know, you're sweating so much over this stuff. That's fine. You know, that's the work. But just do the work. Stop worrying about the result and worrying about is it good enough and all of that. You know, it's a life lesson that I've learned over time. Now I'm in my early 50s. I think about some of this stuff. It's something I tell people just in general in life. Worrying never helps anything, and it never fixes a problem. So, you know, if you can own that and you know, act accordingly, that can actually be pretty helpful to you. In terms of the you know, mistakes I see people making early on, especially, and I see a lot of it now in the internet age where everybody's online and they're all doing all this stuff. If you think that you can write something that's really worthwhile and do it in a very short amount of time, like, oh, I'm going to write a novel in a day or whatever, I would say think again, okay? You know, there are people in certain genres, I guess, who are just, I hate to use the term hack writers, but they just crank out copy as fast as they can, and then they get it out there and sell it, and okay, that's fine, great, you know, good for you, and you might make a bunch of money off it, but if you really think that that's going to outlive you, and people are still going to want to read that stuff years and years from now, no, that's, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah,
I don't know if that answers the question. Sorry.
I mean, everyone answers the question in their own way. So talk to me about, what do you think is the greatest strength in your own writing as you objectively look at it yourself, and how did you develop that?
Sure. When you were talking earlier about my prose and you were being very complimentary, I feel very, very humbled by that, but I also feel like I do have a gift. Now, of course, you know, 10% of it is the gift, and then there's 90%, which is rewriting and rewriting. But the lyrical element of my prose at its best, I think a lot of that developed over many years of writing poems and songs, and people have commented on that a little bit, particularly with my first novel. But a little bit with some of the others as well. And when someone says, you know, oh, your work is very lyrical, or some of this is beautifully written, I'm happy with that. I love that. You know, I don't have any problem with people seeing that, because it's personal to me. It comes right out of me, or through me. And so I'm fine with that. And I think that might be the strongest aspect. It's got my stamp on it. And there's a writer, a terrific writer, who's also writes literary fiction, named Liz Rosenberg. And she was something of a mentor to me when I was in grad school. And she wrote something like, on the blurb of one of my books, she wrote that I write with humor, heart, compassion, and a radiant energy all his own. And I really love that, because I feel that that's true. That energy that comes through, you know, there's part of my personality for sure is in there, and there's no getting around that.
Oh, great. As far as continuing to develop your craft, where's your focus right now, and how are you going about that?
You know, quite honestly, a lot of what I've been doing in the past year to year and a half, even before that, over the past 15 years, I was working on a lot of articles for marketing in a job, and you know, I've been working entirely on my own company, off on my own, since January of last year. So I'm working on marketing my own writing, and that means regular blog posts like the blog that you looked at on my site, and similar articles on my LinkedIn profile. So it's not, you know, a lot of that is really not at all related to the craft of novel writing. I am going to have to spend some time going again over some of the short stories that are coming out later this year, but I have not yet blocked out time to go back into either of the two novels that I have in process. So once I get into that, I'll have a better answer for what I'm doing to develop my craft as far as fiction. I mean, as far as long form fiction, but I don't know what's going to happen with those short stories. They're there. They need to be revised some, but yeah, I don't know.
So talk to me about short fiction. Short fiction, honestly, is like an enigma to me. I mean, I myself am working on a couple short stories, and I kind of feel like I've lost in the dark. I've tried actually looking up several books on it, and anything I've read on short stories just doesn't seem to give me a lot of information. So talk to me about your approach to the short story and how you see it and structure it and how you go about that. Because like I said, for me, I'm not a short fiction writer. Like, any idea I have, I envision a novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the only reason I've even created any short stories is because I started writing some of them before I ever attempted a novel. So, and I don't know that any of those are going to be coming out, because they're very old, and I don't know that any of them are even good enough to use. I'd have to look at them. But I also wrote some short stories here and there over the years while I was working on the novels, and I never published any of them. I submitted a couple of them to magazines here and there and didn't get accepted, so I just kind of backburned all of them because I am truly a novelist. My thinking on it is that a short story can be approached in somewhat the same way as a novel, and that probably goes against everything that everybody else says about short stories. But I want the prose to be good. I want the dialogue to be dialed in, and I just don't have the big palette. You know, with a novel, I know it's going to take a lot of time, and I know I've got a lot of options. And with the short story, I'm going to be in and out in a few pages. You know, I haven't written any short stories that are 30 or 40 pages. They're all 5, 6, 10 pages. And they've all been very organically done. You know, they haven't come out as something where I'm laboring over them for years. I've just cranked them out, and when they were done, they were done. I just said, okay, I guess that's the end. There was no planning process involved. You know, now maybe later after there's a draft, then there's some planning of how to make changes. But yeah, it's an odd form. I think it's a useful form for novelists in that we can put them out there, and if you can build up a platform of short stories that people know about before you've ever tried to publish your first novel, from a marketing standpoint, that could be great. And the other aspect of it is that you can do what I'm planning to do this year, which is have a giveaway of some short stories, like a short story or some short stories as a collection, and kind of enroll people in that way, and then maybe they'll be willing to pay a couple bucks to buy a novel. The other aspect of it is that it's a good exercise just to try to do them. Just like if you're not naturally a poet, it's good to try to write some poems. You know, you might not want to publish it necessarily, but it just depends on the person and what their needs are, I guess.
Yeah, the whole plan of the short story is essentially kind of a free release as a way to introduce people to my writing. I don't know if you're familiar with Wattpad, but I plan to put a few out there and different things like that as just a way to draw attention to my writing and to see if people will maybe check out the sample of the book and, you know, maybe go from there.
Exactly. Yeah. And there are other people doing the same thing. And having done a lot of marketing writing over the years, I'm always ultimately at the end of the day, I'm looking through these things, looking at these things from a marketing standpoint, and it may be a good technique or a good strategy. People who write a genre, where they create something that's in a series, they'll have the first book in the series and they'll give it away for free. And then you love that book, so you're willing to shell out some money for the second one and third one. Right. Or they may even give you more than one in the series. But ultimately, you're going to end up wanting to buy some of them. It's a great strategy. For me, I don't have a series. I don't write that way. So how am I going to do it? You know. So I think that might be a way to do it. And we'll see. You know, I haven't done it yet, but I am looking to enroll people that way.
Yeah, yeah. All right. And then so let's go ahead and dive into the book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the premise of the book? And if you could, maybe, you know, I compared it to The Casual Vacancy, which you weren't familiar with, but, you know, compare it to the biggest household name most people might know.
Gotcha. Yeah, you know, you mentioned that one, which I wasn't familiar with, and I actually thought about that, and you know, I think that my most visible influences are people like Kurt Vonnegut and Hunter Thompson and Frank Zappa. Zappa's not known as a writer, but I mean, people who are irreverent and somewhat funny and not afraid to use language in a way that might offend people with the dialogue, but it's also intended to be comical. So I don't know that there's a book that I'm familiar with other than like the one that you named, that might be a great example. But the amount of free time I have is really limited. And so I haven't found other people who are doing something similar to what I'm doing. And I'm sorry, there was a second part to that question. What was the second part?
So give us a little bit of the premise and the hook of the book for the listeners.
Right. Well, the shortest version is Guy finds out that his boss is stealing from the company retirement plan. So that might actually appeal to people who are used to reading some kind of genre fiction because there's a crime involved there. The issue is that this guy who's stealing from the plan is second in command in the company. He's not the owner, but he's the boss. So the only other person to go to is the big boss, and that's the owner. And the proof on this is kind of thin. You know, it's not a lot of documented evidence. So if you go to the owner of the company with this and he doesn't believe you and you lose your job, you know, there's no recourse. So it's, you know, that's sort of the dilemma that this character.
So I've got a couple quotes here that I pulled from your book. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was your use of adverbs. So for the listeners, if you listened to the episode on wasted words, we talked about eliminating adverbs and converting them to better verbs. And then we talked about adverbing like J.K. Rowling. And this is very much how Mike uses adverbs in his own work. They have a dramatic impact on the words. And so I wanted him to talk to us about that. So I'm going to read a couple quotes here that kind of illustrate what he's done with them. And then I'll have him kind of explain his approach to that. The dial tone hummed plaintively. And what I liked about this line is the word plaintively is that we're dealing with these lawyers and there's this, you know, this reference to plaintive in that we use very much in the lawyer field. And so you have this lawyer and it's very much a point of view thing. And that's how he thinks about his world is he's just very much immersed in this lawyer lingo. And so I really enjoyed that there. And if we go down to the next one, it's Paul slumped forward onto the desk as if someone had just gently and quietly knifed him. And the idea of being gently and quietly knifed is just very counterintuitive to how you think about that very violent action of stabbing somebody. So go ahead, Mike.
Sure. Well, I'll address the second one first because it'll be fresh in people's minds having just heard it. That actually comes at the end of the first scene with Paul, the protagonist of this book. And he's going through a situation with a lot of people, which a lot of people are familiar with, and that's being at work in a cubicle at a company and bored out of your mind and sitting there on hold. And the hot chocolate in his mug is turning into cold chocolate and the AC is blowing on him and he's on hold listening to a Muzak version of Reeling in the Years by Steely Dan. And then at the end of the scene, on comes a Muzak version of Sweet Jane by the Velvet Underground. I mean, it's just utter torture, and it's all written quite comically. And so if you get to the end of that, and he gets transferred or whatever it is, and he kind of falls forward on the desk, literally, he's being overdramatic and sort of comical too, but he's not doing it because he's having a good time. And so, you know, if you think about the way that a person could write that, how else would you do it? Would you say they, as if someone had slipped the knife into his back, or as if they had, you could change it to all these action verbs, which wouldn't convey humor. And yet, if someone gently knifed you, which is kind of funny, right, and did it very quietly, you know, those adverbs convey the humor to some degree, just like all the rest of the scene before it has conveyed it. So I think that's why they're effective in that context. And to go back to the bigger picture before I address the other one, I don't really care about trends. I'm fine breaking quote-unquote rules, you know, and that's one of the things that I have an issue with in a lot of popular fiction today. There are all these absurd rules about eliminating entire parts of speech. I mean, think about how many adverbs there are in the English language. So for people to come along and say, well, those words are all outdated and outmoded. We should not use any more adverbs. That, to me, is absurd. And there are so many books out there that you can pick up now, And it's all this purple prose without adverbs or adjectives, because everything has to be a dramatic verb. And it's almost like see spot run. John sprinted, Paul crushed, you know, it becomes ludicrous. And you can avoid that by judiciously, there's an adverb, right? Judiciously using adverbs if you have a reason to do it. And so that was my thinking there. Now, I think that came originally quite organically, but in going back and looking for other options to rewrite it, I didn't come up with anything better. I think that actually worked. The other example about the dial tone, what happens before that is the guy throws the phone across the room. He's angry. He throws the phone across the room. It's a landline phone, and it's actually old. It's attached to a cord, so the cord is stretched out across the floor. The cats bolt from the room like children from a drunken parent, and then we have the dial tone hummed plaintively. And if you think about it, if you've ever gone into a room where people just had an argument and the room is empty, they're gone, but you walk into that empty room and you feel that energy. It's very negative energy. And there's really something kind of sad about it, if you think about it. So that's what I wanted to convey with the sound of that dial tone. It's not really that funny once the cats run out of the room and it's just the empty room, or him, the character, and the sound of the dial tone. There's something sad about that. So that's why I think that's why plaintively worked there.
Well, I think it worked on multiple levels. I don't think you could have picked a better word. Like, it is one of the things that I think makes your writing so good is, you know, I think, you know, we have a lot of rules in writing, but I think the difference between a good writer and a great writer is the great writer knows the rules and knows when to break them. And it is that judicious, you know, evaluating of the prose that makes them the great writer, is that they're not bound by the rules, and they recognize that when something works and it's broken the rule, then it has to go that way.
Right. Well, thank you. And that's one of the things that makes editing excruciating, because in going through, you know, I would have to go back and check, but it's very possible that the editor I hired had suggested that I change that. But I didn't.
I've interviewed a number of authors who mention, like, a lot of times the quotes I'll pull out, they'll even mention specifically, be like, yeah, my editor wanted to cut that and I thought about it. The most memorable one is I interviewed a guy named Deke Rue, and his wife is also a writer and an editor. And I had a quote and I read it to him, and he mentioned specifically that he and his wife and his editor had had multiple arguments about that exact sentence, and he had chosen to keep it despite all of their feedback. And I had pointed it out saying I'd really enjoyed it, even though it'd broken all these rules.
Right, right. Well, you know, and if you're looking for things like that as a writer yourself, you'll see that's somewhat of a rule. And it's being broken. But if you're a reader who's just reading, it may not have any effect at all.
Yeah.
You may just take it in and keep going, so it works for you. It doesn't pull you out of the text. And that's a big thing for me. One of my hero writers is a guy named John Gardner, who wrote this book Grendel, based on the Beowulf, but it's told from the monster's point of view. And he says something about, in this book, On Becoming a Novelist, he writes about the idea that as an author, you want your reader to be in this sort of vivid and continuous dream. And once they start reading your prose, the real world falls away and they're just in this sort of dream state and watching characters do things, and they're seeing it all in their mind. They're something of a co-creator, of course, but you don't want things that are going to pull them out of that dream state. And, you know, as long as I'm not pulling the reader out of that, then I feel like I've accomplished my goal in my editing. I think the main thing really is just that I hope that people who pick up a book like Miles of Files will enjoy it and be a better person or at least a better reader from having read it. But I also hope that they're inspired to pick up the other titles as well, because as an independent publisher, I'm putting these things out there and I'm promoting them with the hope that I develop readers who will want to read all of my books and who will be looking forward to the next one. And the reason that I have done this relaunch and promotion with Miles of Files was not just because I thought that this new cover was better than the old one, but because I think that this book has the chance to reach the widest audience out of all the books. So that was kind of why I wanted to talk to you about it. And I think that's really it.
So why don't you tell people where they can find you and your books and whatnot?
Sure. You know, people are driving around and listening to this, or they're on their cell phone or whatever it is. If you go to Google and you type in my last name, S as in Sam, A-H-N-O, immediately the first page of Google results, you'll get my website, msano.com. You'll see, you know, networking page I'm in, so on and so forth. But msano.com is my website, and you can actually find all of the books, ebook versions or print versions you can get direct from me or from some retail outlet like Amazon online. But Barnes and Noble, iTunes, whatever your preference is, they're available on all those platforms.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Joseph. This is terrific.
Over the past few weeks, I've had a lot of people talk to me about book marketing, and I it's something I've tried to graft into the interviews more to figure out what authors are doing. And so with that, I've decided to maybe take a marketing minute and talk about some of the marketing techniques I've been studying and what I've been finding effective. And the first thing I think anyone will tell you is Twitter. And for me, Twitter is not about getting a huge following. It's about networking with authors who are writing the same kind of books as you. And because so many people are on Twitter and it is so easy to find people, that is what I recommend. And so in my own day, the first technique I came across is what they call the Twitter six. So you follow six people in a day. And I like to add the addendum that you want a relative six, right? So you want to find at least six people who are authors and ideally writing in the same genre as you. And so that's our marketing minute for today on first building that platform is find fellow authors writing in the same genre as you on Twitter and follow them. And if you want to go on and build that relationship from there, go ahead. And we'll talk about this more in the next marketing minute. All right. Thanks for listening. That was our interview with Mike Sano about his book, Miles of Files. I think I mentioned it in the interview, and I will repeat it here again. If you are a writer, he is worth picking up, even if he's off genre, just to study the way he approaches prose and how he breaks those rules on adverbs is definitely worth your time if you're doing any kind of serious writing. As always, if you want to support the show, pick up one of Travis's books and leave him a review. And you can find us at startwriting.com and some of the blog pieces at joebandosky.com. Earlier, we were going just with Start Writing. We kind of diverged into Joe Bandosky. I have not made a final choice as to what's going to do here. I've reached some real frustration with WordPress recently, so we might actually be shifting back to Squarespace. So we'll see what happens. I will swap out all these endings once I finally make a choice.